This is Cinephile.
This is incredible. Moonlight won Best Picture.
One of the best actors alive here with us in the studio, Billy Bob Thornton. Great to see you, man.
The point of good acting is that you're supposed to be real.
Great to have here on Cinephile Ice Cube, my new best friend.
Yeah, yay, man.
Here's the man himself, Robert De Niro.
Who can tell what a reaction will be to a film that nobody knows?
Viggo Mortensen.
It's one of those movies that when it finishes, you go, now what's going to happen?
Big guest, Mark Wahlberg.
Ted was one of those pivotal moments in my career, like Boogie Nights, where, you know, the subject matter just seems so ridiculous and absurd. Yet when reading the script, you know, you never want to put it down.
Cinephile. The Adnan Virk Movie Podcast.
Oh, man, I just got finished saying how you have to be on point vocally as Jim Brockmeyer, and I completely punted that one.
Sheridan has professed admiration for Clint Eastwood's towering anti-Western Unforgiven and dark Night of the Soul dramas from Michael Mann. Both are reference points for his adept mix of masculine posturing and wounded soul-searching. That's from John Wenzel, the Denver Post, talking about Wind River, one of two films that we'll be reviewing this time on Cinephile. Great to have you with us, as always, on iTunes is where you can find us. Please give us a rating. I rank my movies at a 4 Maple Leafs. There is a rating at a 5 stars. Leave a review. That's how we keep on going. Coming up, not only Wind River, also a movie called Score, documentary about music and motion pictures. Last Rampage, if you listened last time, that was the live podcast that I hosted. Robert Patrick, Dwight Little, etc. from this new crime film. We'll play you an excerpt from those interviews. Morgan Freeman's best films and God Doth Have a Sense of Humor. Dan Stanzik, I hope heaven has a giant shine box for Frank Vincent. Rest in peace. A great character actor, especially in Goodfellas and Raging Bull and Casino. And I loved him in The Sopranos. He'll be the focus of our Scorsese stories. But first and foremost, in the interest of self-promotion, Chris Connolly, who was a part of the Oscars All Access show with me and Ben Lyon, Sophia Carson, Troy Gentile, he sent me an email last week, so congratulations. And sure enough, you heard the moonlight drop there. ABC's The Oscars All Access won the Emmy. Unscripted interactive program. So, of course, the Emmys that all of you will be watching will be this Sunday, hosted by Colbert, which I can't wait to see. But you have all the other categories, which, you know, they have the pre-Emmys, so to speak. The Emmys before the Emmys. And sure enough, thanks to Ben Lyons, who's the one who hooked me up with being there, Outstanding Creative Achievement in Interactive Media within an Unscripted Program. The winner goes to ABC's The Oscars All Access. So, Dan, I'm an Emmy winner.
Congratulations. We gotta update our imaging. Cinephile is hosted by Emmy award-winning Adnan Virk. Are you going to get a physical Emmy?
That is, of course, the first major question that anybody would ask. I sent Megan, who's the producer, who tweeted out some pictures of her receiving the Emmy. And she's, of course, the one who organized everything. So I just sent a quick, hey, congratulations. So thrilled to be a part of it. She's like, oh, thanks, Adnan. And I didn't feel it was appropriate to then ask, do I get...
Oh, you're the talent. That's totally appropriate.
So I'm going to go through Ben Lyons. I'll text Ben or I'll call Ben. I'm sorry, can you talk to Megan? Do we get one?
You're the one that announced that Moonlight won Best Picture. That's
right.
What went viral.
Right, but
there is no Emmy without you doing that, I don't think.
I appreciate it. But if you look at the category, it's Creative Achievement in Interactive Media within an Unscripted Program. That's nothing.
With the audience, that's you. The audience was interacting with you. You are the audience. By the way,
yeah,
you're a Grammy, an Oscar, and a Tony away from the EGOT.
I love it. Dan Stanzik, one-man PR machine. Which brings us to the sore point last time about my reviews and my man Mike Benzani. And you have to take this upon yourself, Dan. You've got to talk to Pete Genesini and find out where we can place the Cinephile, because I'm hearing deaf ears from Genesini. I don't think he cares that much, but we've got to put this somewhere.
Genesini's all in. I'll talk to him.
All right. So Bonds immediately listened to last time, and he was furious. So he said, I was listening to the pod on the way home last night. Thanks for the shout-out. Your boy Dan got my goat a little when he was giving it to you for your high average rating. I added the Rotten Tomatoes ratings to the Cinephile, and the average Rotten Tomatoes rating for all of your reviews is 79%. And your average review is a 3.1. So you're generally reviewing good movies. Tell Dan to suck it.
Don't let these stats get in the way of a good story.
Cinephile 2.0 now is what Bonds has put together. So hopefully we'll get that out there for the people at some point in time. All right, let's talk some movies. So I had a night off, Danny. going through my vast DVD collection. Guess what movie I popped in? You and I have never discussed this movie. I hope you like it as much as I do. I ain't seen it in a few years.
How am I supposed to guess what movie we've never discussed before?
Former Best Picture winner.
Ooh. Kramer versus Kramer.
No. Blu-ray 5 years ago?
The Artist.
No, good guess. Same year as The Social Network, which some quibbled should have won Best Picture.
What beat it?
Social Network was more kind of
gritty. Yeah, was it Zero Dark Thirty?
No, this was like a classic Hollywood film. Colin Firth, Jeffrey Rush.
Oh, King's Speech?
Like, popped in the King's Speech on a Wednesday
night.
Colin
Firth won Best Actor, too, right?
I gotta admit, it was a little dry. Like, I didn't feel the need to go through the whole thing. I just liked the first scene where Jeffrey Rush meets him, and I love the ending, of course, when he does the speech. That great scene when they first meet, because, you know, Colin Firth, King George VI, is so apprehensive about doing this, and he's just an irritable crank. And he starts smoking, and Rush goes, no, not here. My castle, my rules. And Colin Firth's like, what do you mean? He goes, my doctor tells me it relaxes me. He goes, I don't find sucking cigarette smoke into one's lungs can be healthy. And he goes, but the doctor said it. He goes, they're idiots. And he said, they've been knighted. He goes, well, that confirms it then. Really literate script, well directed by Tom Hooper. And the ending is great. Of course, when the king gives the speech, at the end, Jeffrey Rush says, well done. And he goes, you still stumbled on the W's. And Colin Firth says, well, I had to stumble a little bit. Otherwise, they had to know that it was me. But it's a really smart movie, classically done. I did remember that was a pretty big debate, though, if that should have won or Social Network. The Social Network fans said that was a real contemporary movie. Like, it was really about Facebook and our generation. The King's Speech is a nice, well-made, tasteful movie, but it's, you know, it's one of these classic movies about England 300 years ago. Who cares? That was their theory. But when I watched one of the Q&A on the DVD, Ben Lyons is one of the blurbs. I'm watching the Q&A, and it goes, oh, new film. And then it goes, destined to be one of the best pictures of the year. Ben Lyons, E.
Speaking of Ben, did we ever get his top 10?
No. He moved. He's now part owner of a deli in Los Angeles. It's called like Haskell's Deli. He's just never gave us a top 10.
I mean, he tweets about the Knicks a lot, and I love him for it. Like, Porzingis is going to have a huge year, and let's go. But we need that top 10.
He's an avid listener, so I guarantee he'll listen, and hopefully he'll send us a top 10. But
well, this is like the fifth time I've mentioned it.
It's true. It's going to be a little bit dated by the time we get around to it. It'll be 2018. But he may be getting me an Emmy. So that's the King's Speech. I also watched Heat again the other day, a movie you and I haven't discussed. I'm assuming you like it.
Yeah, I mean, I think the hype for it, I mean, I was 9 when it came out, but Pacino and De Niro on the screen at the same time for the first time really was, I mean, it's fine. I don't think it's that great.
I was about to say, you surprised at all, did not receive any Academy Award recognition. Was not nominated for Best Picture. There was no...
Not really.
Right. You thought it was a solid crime film.
Yeah.
It's funny, watching it again, it's really atmospheric. I love the way Michael Mann shoots it. And the bank robbery scene is tremendous. For the most part, it's well acted. But some of those scenes of dialogue, it's either like really crisp and authentic, or it's just like howlingly bad. I'll give you an example of a good one. Val Kilmer, when he's talking to De Niro, this is early on, and like he's been kicked out of the house. He's drinking again. And Charlene, played by Ashley Judd, mad at him. And De Niro says, you got something on the side. And he goes... This is nothing regular, which is like, he's talking about how much he loves me. He's like, oh, nothing regular, yeah, nothing steady. And he goes, how about her? He goes, nothing. He goes, you sure? He's like, yeah, nothing. And then later, De Niro was kind of inferring that he should walk away, and he just goes, hey, man, for me, the sun rises and sets with her, which I thought is a beautiful line. Like, I love that line. But then later, they get these scenes, like the scenes with Pacino and Diane Venora, his wife, are just so on the nose. Like, the one part that she says to him, you hunt for the scent of your prey. And he goes, I got to hold on to my angst. Keeps me sharp, on the edge, where I got to be. And I'm like, nobody talks this way. Like some of those, like I couldn't imagine the cutting room. They're going like, is that a little bit? We get it. It's not a very original story. Obsessed cop, career criminal. He's lonely. Finds Amy Brenneman. He can't stay focused because he's on his third marriage. But I mean, sometimes you can subvert that. And I think because of the technical expertise and the music and the whole theme of it, it works. But some of that dialogue and the other crux of it, which is always debatable, and I need your thought on this, Dan. Because I think De Niro is lean and mean. He's excellent. I think Val Kilmer's great. Ashley Judd, Amy Brenneman. Pacino's my favorite actor. But is Pacino's performance in Heat a great performance? Because he's playing Vincent as this outsized character. And Michael Mann told him De Niro's going to be quiet and reserved. So your character has to be theatrical. You get killed walking your doggy. Or is it a terrible Pacino performance, and it was the tipping point for when he started to become a character of himself and just started yelling all the time?
Well, you've already gone on the record, and you said Scent of a Woman is when he overdid it, and that's actually when he won an Academy Award.
Right, which 3 years before Heat.
Right, so you already, that predates Heat. I would say it is not a great performance. Yeah. Like, if we've never done the actor showcase of Pacino, but if we did, that would be nowhere near the top five.
That is
And he hasn't made a great movie in 25 years, really.
Insomnia, 2001.
Right, that's probably the only one. I don't think that'd be in his top five either.
No, you're right.
So if Heat's not even in Pacino's top eight, we'll call it, can we say it's a great role? No way.
No, I think I'm with you on that. It's funny. I have people who just, but he's so entertaining. You know, he's just screaming at Tom Luke. I'm like, yeah, I get it. But I mean, sometimes it just seems like he's just barking for no reason. But I do love the coffee shop scene. Great. Like, as Dan said, the whole hype was these two guys together, and both those guys knocked out of the park. It's a wonderful scene. If you haven't seen Heat, came out way back in 1995. Go check it out once again as I revisited that film from Michael Mann. Speaking of Michael Mann, I read that blurb there from the film critic from the Denver paper who said Wind River reminded him of that in some ways, and that's the first film that we're reviewing today. Wind River is the story about a murder which takes place on a Native reservation, and there's an FBI agent played by Elizabeth Olsen. Callow youth is being served. You can tell right away she's out of her element, isn't used to murders, and certainly something of this kind of severity. But they're sending her there because she's the closest to the reservation, which immediately raised the issue. I was like, well, there must be something closer. There has to be some Wyoming FBI. But regardless, she's flown in from Vegas. And Jeremy Renner plays a guy who is a hunter, literally a hunter. That is his job. And he's the one that first discovers the body. And Olsen quickly realizes that she's out of her depth. And Renner is there helping her just, you know, because obviously they're finding the body and going over it. And she kind of recruits him. Listen, can I help you? I don't know the lay of the land here. And it's just all snowy and bleak and freezing. And she shows up. She's not ready for the weather. And right away, you know, the other FBI agents are kind of mocking her. So you've got this kind of fish out of water feel to it, this character who's out of her depth. But it becomes this really heavy drama, which is not only about trying to find the murderer of this young girl, but also about Renner's own backstory. And you soon come to realize that he himself is dealing with his own demons and the fact that he lost a girl around the same age. And they really play it well. When Olsen has to get dressed up to go to deal with the weather because she's not ready for it, she's wearing his dead daughter's clothing. So it's when Renner, imagine you're seeing your daughter's clothing on somebody else who's like a young girl, it just kind of throws him off right away. And it's, you can already tell he's unnerved by it. And it's a shame I hadn't seen the movie before Renner actually paid us a visit here in Bristol, because I thought he was terrific in it, and it would have been nice to ask him some questions about it. But in terms of playing a character who is brooding and dealing with these pain of the past, Renner's excellent. You know, you think about Sean Penn in Mystic River or Jack Nicholson, The Crossing Guard. You know, there's many actors who have kind of taken on that challenge of playing someone who's dealing with the death of a loved one. Particularly a daughter, but I thought Renner was excellent. There's one scene in particular where he tells Olsen, you know, she says, okay, what happened? Like, finally revealed to me what has happened. And he's got a great line, speaking of dialogue, he says, you know, if you ever have kids, you can never lay your guard down, you know, not for a second. You've always got to keep your eye on them, which was impactful. So the story develops and it becomes, like I said, this murder mystery. So on the one hand, you have this character study about Renner and what, you know, his relationship with Olsen, and then also trying to find the murder. So I enjoyed the human interest parts of it and the character study. What I didn't think was as strong was some of the plot contrivances. And literally, there is a standoff in the movie, which I was like, you always hear that expression. And I thought of Heat, you know, that great scene, obviously, the bank robbery, because it's so well staged. This is literally like nine characters all pointing guns at each other. And listen, in Reservoir Dogs, it's fine. You got three guys. But once it's like over six, you go, how in, like, it just felt so implausible when I was watching the scene. Speaking of dialogue, a few of the scenes also had some really on the nose dialogue that felt a little heavy handed. So, as much as I appreciate the story and I like the impact of it, I did think some of the plot was a little bit wonky, and some of the dialogue, like I said, was a little bit too on the nose. But I'm still giving it three Maple Leafs. It's from the director Taylor Sheridan. He's the guy who did Hell or High Water and also did Sicario. So this is the third of his trilogy of, he's saying, stories about the American frontier. And what I really, something else that I enjoyed about it, this kind of lends it some originality, is he's focusing on what happens, particularly with Native peoples on these reservations, and they show statistics that the end crawl. The end crawl can be really impactful. Think of Spotlight, which I watched recently. You know, that last scene, he says, you know, the phone hasn't stopped ringing. And then the crawl comes up. Listen, because of this case in Boston, they uncovered sex abuse crimes in all of these places, you know, from Brazil to Cambodia to you name it. The crawl at the end of Wind River explains that Native women, like, they're the most missing persons by a wide margin. If you go Caucasian, African-American, Latino, Asian, et cetera, Native Americans go missing all the time. And part of it is that, okay, it's this closeted, guarded community, but as you can see in the movie, it's just an afterthought for a lot of law enforcement. They say, okay, you know what, it's too tough to investigate. No one's going to say anything. We don't want to do the due diligence to discover the clues and follow through with it. So I give any movie credit that makes me think about it afterwards, and I thought about it afterwards on the note of empathy, the fact that this happens so often and nothing is done about it. So kudos to Taylor Sheridan for tackling some subject matter that was a little bit different. So I liked Wind River. Once again, Three Maple Leafs. Check it out. It was a really dull summer, aside from, of course, Dunkirk, and I guess Wonder Woman was the number one box office movie. But Wind River, a movie that actually I thought was quite good. The critics reviewed it well. And just like Hell or High Water came out in August, so hopefully Taylor Sheridan can make some magic, although the latest Gold Derby, we don't have it ranking very high when it comes to Oscar picks. The other movie I want to review before we get to the last Rampage interviews is called Score. That's a motion picture documentary. And for anybody that loves music and loves the impact that it has on movies, well, obviously this is a must-see. And the story starts out just showing a couple of composers, how they actually put together their films, and then away we go. And they're explaining just the lineage of movies and how, listen, silent films back then, of course, they were not silent. They did not have dialogue. But obviously they had music the whole time. So music's always been an integral part of movies. And as one of the composers explains, you know, either you have two types generally of directors who are asking for music. Either they will show you a rough cut of the movie or give you the basic sense of it, or they will just say, give me a music bed, give me the music, and then I can just lay it out wherever I want. It can cross cut between different scenes and go from there. And so obviously that's the challenge. And what the movie really nails is seeing all these composers in their habitat. You see them playing with like a xylophone, playing on the piano, playing with drums, playing the guitar. You see them actually in charge of the orchestra on all the strings. And in terms of music background, they explain how Alex North, he was a really important composer because he did Streetcar Named Desire. That was the first soundtrack that actually had jazz in it. And obviously they play the music in there, so it fits with what you're saying. Probably the heavyweight champion, I would go with Bernard Herrmann, Hitchcock's longtime composer. And Hitchcock loved him so much. You know, normally when you're watching a movie, you have the credits, it'll go screenplay and then director. Hitchcock revered Herrmann and thought he was so important to his movies, he gave him almost second billing if you look at the movies. And particularly this show, Psycho, that great scene, of course, the shower sequence, and how that music just hammers you and it makes you feel like you're seeing a lot more than you actually did. So Herman Oxy, Vertigo obviously is a great soundtrack as well, obviously one of my favorite movies, and I think it's Hitchcock's best. They explain Vertigo, why that music was so important as well. And then about 30 minutes in, they get to, I think for guys like me and Dan, and probably most people, I would say the GOAT, and that is John Williams. My friend Kerry Chow one time, because John Williams recently got the AFI tribute, American Film Institute, Lifetime Achievement Award. He was like, you know, how great is John Williams? And just to be a contrarian and to bug Kerry, I said, well, I'm more of a Morricone fan. Of course, Morricone did the Spaghetti Westerns, The Untouchables, and The Hateful Eight, which he finally won an Oscar for. But that was just to annoy Chow. In all honesty, Morricone's great. But John Williams, you start to listen to each of those soundtracks. Like, just start with Jaws. Like, just how inspired was he to go the dun, 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 dun? Like, how did he come up with this? And they show Spielberg talking with him. This is way back in the mid-70s. And he actually himself was a musician. He had been working on, I want to say it was Guys at West Side Story. He was one of the musicians, not actually in West Side Story, but was a part of the music for it. So he didn't naturally come to composing with that classical background. But Spielberg kind of discovered him. They started working together. And you know, sometimes with the composers, you have a motif. So you have that with Close Encounters of the Last Kind. Dun, 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 dun. You know, it goes from there. So then that familiar motif comes. And they explain with the movies, when there's that motif, it tells you what to think. In Lord of the Rings, they use familiar motifs a lot. So when you hear that music, you go, oh, that's Aragorn's music, or that's Frodo's music. So it kind of tells the audience what to think. So Williams is incredible. I mean, they show like 10 minutes of it. Raiders of the Lost Ark is an amazing one. And even the Raiders of the Lost Ark, one of the composers talks about it and says, you know, with Williams, it's like he finds that indelible, infectious rhythm that everybody knows that they hum. But then the other parts of the score are actually really well done as well. And it's almost like a filmmaker. It's like, okay, this one's for you. This one's for me. This one's for the audience so everybody will know about it. But this is actually the music that's really good. And with Star Wars, again, one of the greatest soundtracks of all time, everybody knows the opening with the opening crawl. But he goes, if you listen to the Emperor's March, like that is great music. And like it's really well composed. And if you're a real musician, if you're a musician's musician, as they would say, you'll appreciate the different music within John Williams' scores rather than just the major ones that you know, Star Wars, Raiders of the Lost Ark. I happen to think Schindler's List is a great soundtrack. I mean, that's a soundtrack that'll make you cry the way he uses that single violin. And it showed that he didn't just have to have these big up-tempo orchestral old-school scores. He could do something really haunting and moving. And they talk about different composers. Jerry Goldsmith's a famous one on Chinatown. He insisted on having four pianos. He said, why do you have to have four pianos? But Jerry goes, that's the way it's going to work. And again, he would put together music for that. Thomas Newman's a composer who kind of has his own feel to it. And one guy I know Dan and I like a lot, Hans Zimmer. A lot of Hans Zimmer's featured in the movie, Christopher Nolan's guy. And they explain, they go, the way that Hans Zimmer uses strings is like using guitars. Like he just kind of bangs it together. Like it's got this real aggression to it. It's like he's doing Led Zeppelin like with guitars. And they show the Dark Knight score, of course, and Inception is a really good score. They played some music from that. So, honestly, if you love music and you love what scores can provide, I think it's really good. My only criticism of the film is I would have liked to have seen the filmmakers talking about the music. I appreciate the fact he put the spotlight on those musicians, on those composers in their natural habitat, but I would have loved to have seen contemporary Spielberg talking about what John Williams did. I would have loved to have seen Christopher Nolan telling you the impact of Hans Zimmer. I would have liked to have seen Francis Ford Coppola talking about why the music is so important that he's had, you know, from Nino Rota or whomever he's had in his film. So that was the only downside to it. But I really thought it was a good film from a USC graduate, in fact, my friend Claire Atkins. She went to school with him. So he's the one who put it together, wrote and directed it. So I know Mark Sion will be all over it because he loves his documentaries. Score, a motion picture documentary, definitely a film that you would enjoy. Dan, you got to appreciate the music of the movies, right? It's a separate subset. Probably doesn't get enough love oftentimes.
I don't think it's talked about enough either. And I think people don't even realize how impactful it is when they're watching a movie. Like we talked about it after we saw Dunkirk together, that music kind of sets the tone the entire way. And it was almost like nonstop. And we didn't really breathe until the music stopped like halfway through. And we're like, okay, we can take a breath now. Oh my goodness. And it was a quick breath. And then the rest of the movie, the music's hammering again.
Right.
So even all these Sports Center pieces that we do, like all this stuff. For example, today on Mike and Mike, we played Adam Schefter's speech to Michigan before they played this weekend.
Right.
And the music set underneath it makes it seem like it was the greatest speech of all time. But if you just had the Schefter audio, you would be like, eh. That's okay. But you have the music and you're like, oh my God, that was great. But I mean, we love Schefter, but he's like this 5'6" guy. Is he really pumping up the Michigan players to play whoever the hell they were playing? No, but you hear the music and it's packaged nicely together and it was amazing.
Yeah, speaking of that, using music that you wouldn't expect, remember The Titans, which is a movie I don't particularly care for. The music's really good in it. They show Obama used that, I think, in 2008 after one of his speeches, maybe Democratic Convention. I don't know specifically. But they show the composer. He goes, well, I wasn't crazy about it because they didn't ask me. Like, if they wanted to use it, that's one thing. But a buddy might call me and goes, hey, they're using your music. Like, Obama finished his speech, and all of a sudden, bam, remember The Titans for like 20,000 people. Like, ah! He goes, like, talk about an emphasis. Talk about an exclamation point to one of your speeches. And he goes, look, I have no issue if you want to use it for political gain, but just give me a heads up. Another good soundtrack, Mad Max. They show the way that he literally creates that soundtrack with all the drums and the way that George Miller wanted it just to be elegant.
We
got to
do that one day, one of these podcasts, your top five soundtracks or scores. Like, I think there's something here.
Oh, I agree. It would be tough to narrow it down just to top five. I feel like it would be top 50. But, yeah, if you have a favorite, let us know. Tweet us at CinephileESPN. And, of course, we're also available on Instagram, CinephileESPN. Morgan Freeman's Best Films plus an honorarium of Frank Vincent. But first, we hear from the cast and crew of Last Rampage, a new crime film out, stars Robert Patrick, Heather Graham. You'll hear Robert coming up. You'll hear the director, Dwight Little. You'll hear one of the screenwriters and a couple other actors as well. So enjoy Last Rampage, currently coming out to theaters soon. It'll be available on VOD as of September 22nd.
Well, thanks so much, guys. Thanks for a terrific experience. Robert, I'll start with you. What was it about this story? Based on a true story, of course, crime, prison break, set back in Arizona in 1978. What was it about the story that attracted you to it?
Well, there's so many things on so many levels that were really attractive about it. If you believe in good, you got to believe in bad. It has biblical undertones to it and overtones, and I play a good guy throughout the year on a TV show, and Dwight sent me the script. I've worked with Elvaro and I get to come up to your level. All right. Thank you. We got an even higher chair. From the bottom to the top. But it was really appealing to me because it was a total juxtaposition to what I do 9 to 5, and I thought it was just a rich script. he's amazing with dialogue and the way he weaved the story, and it's just such a powerful story. A man who's willing to walk all over everybody to get his freedom and his children. It's not every day you get to play a character that's such a monster, and he was literally the devil. And it was just a wonderful challenge, and to work with Dwight in a feature film format as opposed to some of our TV stuff. You tell a really rich story. I don't know. I the opportunity to play somebody as evil as this was irresistible.
You knocked it off.
I hate to say it. I mean, I watch the movie and I cringe when I watch it. I'm just like, oh my God, what a piece of just despicable. But it's a true story, and we have to remind ourselves there's a lot of evil people out there in the world, and whenever you start to get a little bit too comfortable, they're going to rise up and expose themselves. So,
I love the point you made, Robert, about the biblical overtones. One of the best lines in the movie is that line about, cleaner than a horse Bible because she's never touched
it. Yeah, that's from El Barro.
Yeah.
I know he's a church-going guy. I'm a church-going guy. I believe in all that. And, you can't believe in heaven unless you believe in hell. So that line in particular was outstanding. All right.
Alvaro, how did you find the script? I mean, again, adapting a story based on a book, of course, true story. How challenging was that to take the source material? Of course, you've got to make changes and streamline it for a feature film, but how did you tackle that?
I think that I was, definitely there was a first draft of the script that existed, and that's the kind of blueprint that kind of I worked from. But really, I think the story really opened up when I had been working with Dwight on it for several months, maybe almost a year. I hadn't really cracked how to tell the story. And when it really cracked for me was kind of in the realization that this was really a story about Donnie, the oldest son, realizing that his father's, insane and is trying to do whatever he can to get his younger brothers out of the situation. And once that kind of opened up the world of the story to me, then the characters really just started talking. And so a lot of it is, this is a true story, but a lot of it is just the way that the characters started talking. And as I was rewriting the script over and over again, the characters revealed themselves to me. From Randy to, the sons, Gary, it's true, but it's also made up at the same time, So the dialogue stuff is just, not me, it was the characters talking.
Yeah, it's like Ang Lee, the great filmmaker, once said, you have to pretend to get closer to the truth. Sometimes it does make sense in that respect. Not only the great dialogue, Alvaro, but Dwight, it was so atmospheric, reminded me in some ways of Hell or High Water, recent Southern crime film, reminded me of One False Move, that great Carl Franklin movie.
These aren't the worst comparisons I've ever heard. That's not bad.
How were you able to kind of capture that tone? Because that's so critical, this kind of story. It has to feel authentic. The characters have to feel lived in.
Well, I think we were all here because of Al's script, first of all. I mean, once you read those, I read the first 25 pages. I'd been working with it for a while. Jason actually brought this book to me a long time ago. We'd been fooling around with it, couldn't crack it. I read Alvaro's 25 pages, and I said, oh, my God, now we got a movie. And it's all on the page. And then what we tried to do is cast it as authentically as we possibly could. And then from there, the visuals begin to grow. And we went out and found these locations that were just dusty and harsh and rugged and reflected this very, very desolate world that the Tysons, lived in that time in Arizona. And so we went into that dusty brown world, and I think you could see how grimy these actors were. They were messed up. But it's for a director, it's script, 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 and then it's casting, 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 and then you bring your art to it. But once you have those two things in place, you're in a good position for success.
I think you're being honest. I think you're being humble as well. So I appreciate the combination of both. Jason, you know, Robert's talking about something different from his 9-to-5 job. And of course, you're known for the Free Willy franchise. This could not be a greater departure. At least you're on the good side of the law. But obviously, totally, it's so much more different. What was it like for you to approach this type of character?
Well, it was fun. And obviously challenging, like, for all the rest of the actors. You know, it was something that I've had, you know, the book since 96, and brought this to Dwight and sort of playing with the story. And the reason the story resonated with me was because it was about a father and his sons and the willingness for these boys just to sort of, you know, put the blinders on because dad, you know, he's the father, he's the provider, and they want that relationship. And those aspects of the story attracted me. The relationship between the wife and Gary was very disturbing, and then just Cooper's hunt for this guy. You know, it's all in the book, so it's all floating there. And then thankfully, eventually, this road that I've been on led me to getting it to Al through by way of Dwight. And I'm just grateful to be sitting on the stage and have these incredible actors and these people. And there you go.
Chris, sometimes, you know, these stories are so intense. You need to have some levity when it's not action, just to kind of break it up a little bit. And then sometimes the arrow goes the other way, that it's intensity and services throughout to try to maintain that level. What did you find the experience was like in making this kind of movie?
Well, that was kind of the cool thing about the way that Dwight works, and a lot of it was just, you know, on the fly. There's a lot of ad-libbing in the movie, but I found it like that happens a lot when you start with the script, with a great script. It's like, this is another thing that Randy would say. You know, I don't know. I
the best line in the movie.
Right.
The worst line would
happen. Yeah. See, that would happen. Maybe. I don't know. But no, I don't know if it was or not. But it was just a thing where there were times the thing in the back of the van when we were at the brother's house. That was just Dwight saying, "Hey, I like that." It was Robbie saying, "The lighter being on looks cool because he's the DP," and so he liked that lighter. And then Dwight was like, "Just talk to, just kind of get in his ear." You know, I'm sitting behind Donnie's chair. He says, "Just go, just roll it, just start."
Well, here's the director. Now, what I like to do is after we've had table read and we get out on location, give the crew the first shot, give them the setup, let them know what they're doing so they can get to work. And then we sit down, whether it's at picnic tables or folding tables and folding chairs, and we just sit there. Remember, we'd all just sit around. And we work these scenes. And it doesn't, you know, 20, 25 minutes, just hear them and listen. Al would always be there, make a little changes. And then by the time you're out to go to the floor, you figured it out. You can't do it with the camera staring at you. You got to just sit down and think. And then once your thinking time is done, then you have to jump into the filmmaking, which is tricky. You know, it's got to be in focus, and it's got to be lit. And it's all got to be done in less time than you have. And so the director note that I've learned is, you know, every minute you spend in rehearsal is, you know, three moments that you get back. So that's the way to do it. Get those actors rehearsed.
Yeah, that was true. That was like a thing that made it really comfortable, because we'd always work while the guys were setting up. The actors would be working on stuff, and it just got to a comfort level that no one was worried, at least I wasn't, and then I didn't see anybody else worried about it either. When the camera was rolling, we always kind of knew that it was going to work. And we were on we were working fast, and we seemed to, we didn't ever feel like we didn't get something. Right. You know, we were there, and it was like, oh, that was great. We move on. It's really cool. It's the most comfortable I've ever been on a set.
one of the most chilling scenes in the movie is that murder of that family, and you can feel the build up to it. It's so suspenseful. Al, tell me about when you wrote it and conceived it, and then Dwight, tell me about the execution of it.
The first family?
Yeah.
Yeah. You know, there's a moment that's in the script that's not in the movie that has always kind of like stuck with me, which is, you know, which is in the book too, and the reality of what happened. Once they unload the weapons on the family in the car, there's silence for a moment. And then you hear the baby crying. And they go back to kill the baby. And that was like an element that, you know, we kind of talked about back and forth. Should that be in the movie? Should that not be in the movie? In the end, it's not in the movie. But, you know, to me, that was sort of like a key moment of like how, you know, to use his word, evil, this, you know, these guys were. But there was something, you know, that whole scene was, you know, something that just, to me, it reveals so much about all of the different characters that are, you know, from the family. You, without knowing the family, you kind of know the family pretty quickly. You know, the woman is saying, this is my son, his name is Christopher Lyon. She's trying to identify, you know, this is a real person, it's not, you know. You have the kids, you know, trying to comfort each other. This is going to be okay, you know. You have the moment where Gary asks Donnie, go get me a jug of water. And Donnie's like, all right, he's going to leave a jug of water for them, and we're going to go.
Yeah.
But then Gary's like, no, bring it back to me. And, you know, so there's a lot of, like, elements that I think kind of play out in a scene that, you know, is kind of a harrowing moment in the movie.
I'm not sure Gary, I toyed around with this a lot in my own head. I'm not sure Gary Tyson knew until the very end that he was going to do that. And it wasn't until you took that drink of water that I knew that that was going to happen. You know, it was like, even to the moment when he was saying, get the water and take it to the family, I think he was still calculating how long would they be there before they were found. How many miles could they get behind them? And then he just calculated that it was them or him. And I think, I don't know if that was a nasty drink of water.
Nasty drink of water, but I remember Chris and I and you, we're all sitting there talking, and we're going like, all right, so how do we deal with the fact we're going to kill this kid? And what we came up with was, we have a little conversation before, where Chris and I were working it out, and we kind of decided that, it's going to sound weird, but from our character's point of view, it was a mercy killing. This poor baby's never going to be found. The predators are going to come in, or the vultures, the everybody's going to come in and pick them apart, and this poor baby's going to be left here, and geez, I feel bad about leaving the baby, and we should just kill it too. And I, you know, it's, that's
well, Randy
pretty
said,
sick.
Randy said he did that kid a favor, right?
Yeah. Later on, he does say that. But I remember that conversation. We're all trying to, how do we rationalize this? Yeah, it's a mercy killing.
Yeah, and that was the thing that you did. It's in the movie too, where you like, you know what? Let's just mumble a little huddle before we do, so you can see that we're working it out right then. That was a great idea.
And Chris, I really appreciated your performance, especially seeing you here. Handsome man, you're not like the way some of these guys are so grimy, just kind of dirty. And that kind of a character, I would imagine as an actor, you can kind of tiptoe that line and start to go into cliches, this redneck, southern fried, et cetera. But like that character, I've seen him. I mean, I've stopped at gas stations. I've seen a guy like that. I can recognize that person. I swear, like I said before, I don't know what they're capable of. But how did you find navigating that between, like I said, you don't want to dovetail into cliches, but this guy does kind of have that that redneck essence to him.
Yeah, I mean, I kind of grew up with those guys. I was those guys. I am that guy. I'm in the character right now. That's really how I go through life. I figured that you know that I didn't want to get into, like you were saying, about the cliche business. I was worried about. I did want him to be a chain smoker, and I don't know how many.
You got that done.
You got that done. And it was one of those things where it was like, Mike, could I? Should I have a cigarette? I want to have another cigarette, but in this scene, in this scene, and it was like, well, let's just not. And I ended up pretty much having a cigarette in every scene. But yeah, I just thought because it was going to turn into a thing. Yeah, and I yell on my teeth up.
You know,
yeah, we went a little big on the yellow one day. It looked a little much, but those herbal cigarettes.
I'd love to get with some of them.
Yeah, absolutely. A couple more, and then I promise we'll go to the crowd as well.
You know, but, I want to say something real quick. I just want to say, I mean, this is a true life story, and these poor victims, I mean, this is just horrible, horrible, horrible. And we're sitting here talking about it, and it's, I mean, we're talking about it from an actor's point of view. This is an incredibly tragic event, and families and survivors, I mean, God bless them, and you know, I can't imagine. It's just that horrible, and I don't want to lose sight of that. You know, there's some real people that are still torn up about it.
Absolutely, you don't want to sensationalize that. One more, and I promise we'll go to the crowd. So I just want to ask you about directing Heather Graham, an actress who I don't think many would associate with this type of a role. How did you find working with her?
Well, my first encounter with Heather was on the phone. And she was interested in the script, wasn't fully on board, really, because it was such a departure for her. And we spoke for about 2 hours, and she was so thorough with her questions that she wanted to know what religion the Tysons were. She wanted to know their family history. She wanted to know everything about Dorothy, what her childhood had been. And she was so deep into it in this phone call. And I'd had my head in this, so fortunately I could field these questions. And then after that conversation, I think she realized that there was something in her past that she could find to use for Dorothy. Her father was an FBI man, and there had been some rigid thinking in her family, and she had broken away from that, and I don't want to give away her life story, but she had things that she was able to bring to Dorothy, I will tell you one just practical thing. You're on set, and it's 3 o'clock in the morning, and you need Heather Graham on set, and you're looking around, and I'm like, well, someone go to the base camp and get her. We need this shot. And over your shoulder, you know, you hear, I'm here. And she just sits on set, and she's ready to go, so a complete pro. And just she was prepared. And she was a pleasure, honestly.
Actors Showcase.
Morgan Freeman has a voice that belongs in the Smithsonian, but of course he's more than just a voice. He is a great actor as well. It pains me that I'm not going to include in the Actors Showcase a movie he did called Street Smart. He plays this terrible hustler, you know, street thug. And it was a really important movie for him. Came out in 1987, starred Christopher Reeve. Shout out to Will Reeve, his son who works at ESPN. Because Freeman said, you know, it showed that I could play a bad guy. You know, I wasn't just some TV actor. I could actually have some skill to me. So Street Smart, you don't often see him as a villain, but I would have liked to include it, but I'm at least mentioning it. Just missing the cut. Again, speaking of great voices, it's tough not to get March of the Penguins in there because you can't imagine it without Morgan Freeman's voice. And also a little gem that won an Oscar called Driving Miss Daisy. Hoke, you're my best friend. Let's kick it off with number 5. That would be Unforgiven, one of the great Westerns of all time. I don't think it's necessarily a stellar role for Freeman, but he's great in it, whether it's the fact that he's seduced by all those prostitutes, keeping his pants, he's apologizing to Clint about that, or the fact he's his loyal friend who stands by William Money as he rides saddle one more time again. Unforgiven's a great film, and I think he lends, this is a word that I think often comes up with Morgan Freeman, a lot of gravitas. You think of Freeman, you're thinking of gravitas. He adds it in Unforgiven. He also adds it in 7 as a career cop just looking to step away. He's got one more case, and of course, it's this gigantic case that he can't get rid of. I loved his world-weary approach, the fact he's so cynical. He's so distrustful of Brad Pitt, this young, cocky detective. Although he's got that one scene where he just laughs maniacally when he meets Brad Pitt and his wife, played by Gwyneth Paltrow. They've got the trains overhead. When Morgan Freeman laughs, it's almost eerie. It's so creepy how happy he gets. But particularly the way he invokes Hemingway in the final line of the movie. You know, Ernest Hemingway said, the world is a great place and worth fighting for. You know, I believe in the second part. Number 3 is Glory. campfire scene alone, again, gravitas. He's the veteran. He's the guy. Listen, Denzel's fiery slave who's just so filled with piss and vinegar and wants to fight everybody. And then you've got Matthew Broderick, who's a conflicted character. You got Cary Elwes, who's trying to help these guys out. Andre Brower, amazing. Is a really intelligent member of the crew who's now kind of being taken down a peg. And then there's Morgan Freeman, the veteran, the chief, the captain. Keep them all on track. Number two is Shawshank Redemption. Voice alone. Think of all the commentaries he does, how strong his narration is. I mean, just watch the last 10 minutes alone, and don't even watch the film. Just listen to the audio. You know, the way he says, get busy living or get busy dying, and the way he says, I'm going to go see my friend Andy. And number one, I'm going with Million Dollar Baby. This is, you could argue one versus two. You could probably go Shawshank 1, Million Dollar Baby 2. But I love both. I love Million Dollar Baby a little more as a film. Again, he's a character that's so critical to Clint Eastwood's Frankie Dunn, this world-weary trainer who's just undergoing a world of hurt and is unable to express it really to anybody except for Freeman's character. And I love that last scene between the two of them together. And again, it's Freeman's narration. Nobody's better than narration, who again is basically writing a letter to Clint's daughter and just says, you know, I wanted to let you know what kind of man your father really was. Million Dollar Baby, Shawshank Redemption, Glory, Seven, Unforgiven, the best films of Morgan Freeman. What do we got missing?
It might be one of the best top fives we've done. I mean, there's a lot to pick from here. I had written down all five of those, and so you got them. A quick note on Street Smart, he was nominated for an Oscar.
Best supporting actor.
So that was early on in his career that really buoyed his career, as you mentioned.
Yeah.
And Glory is one of those soundtracks that I know you love.
Oh,
I
want to
say it's
Horner.
A top five
soundtrack
for you.
Good memory.
Driving Miss Daisy, also nominated for an Oscar. You mentioned that.
Mm-hmm.
The two I had that you did not mention.
Kiss the Girls.
No, not Kiss the Girls. Invictus.
Yeah.
Played Nelson Mandela.
Yeah, that's true.
And then this is just a personal one.
No.
Gone Baby Gone, of
course. Geez, I knew.
Of course. I mean, not the lead role, but he's in it.
Oh.
And Shawshank should be one, but that's, you know, like you said, two and one are debatable. But,
yeah.
You know.
I was going through the filmography. I go, for sure, Dan's going to make the case for Gone Baby Gone.
I mean, I have to, you know.
Fair enough.
This far.
Gone Baby Gone, honorable mention.
A Scorsese story.
One other note on The King of Comedy. I'd mentioned it last time on Cinephile. Then I went back and I had the time to watch the movie again, which is just so funny. Can you just say hi to my husband when he's in the hospital? I've got to get going. I hope you get cancer. May you get cancer. Then I watched the Q&A at Tribeca, which was in 2013. So it's Marty, it's De Niro, and then Jerry Lewis comes out. Jerry Lewis is unbelievable. He takes the glass, like he's putting it in his lips. Like he just makes funny faces the whole time. De Niro and Marty are laughing. And when his first bit, when he comes out there, he's like, hey, Marty, I love you. But he calls him Bobby. He goes, Bobby, great to see you. And he goes, so I just took the 7 train. Right away, I thought 7 train, John Rocker. And he goes, I just took the 7 train. He goes, I haven't taken it in a long time. And he goes, I saw a guy, and he goes, he had a mohawk. And he goes, and it, sticking up were big spiky hair. It was blue, purple, yellow, and green. And I'm staring at him. And he stares back at me and he says, what's the problem, old man? You never did anything unusual in your life? And I thought for a second. I said, no, actually, 20 years ago, I had sex with a peacock. I was wondering if you were the son. Marty just explodes in laughter. De Niro gives it a good laugh. And then Marty's laughing so hard. He goes, this is what we shoot on King Comedy. Because we'd make Scorsese laugh so hard he'd have an asthma attack. Well, it's like, it's true. Because somebody can have a gas mask. Marty Scorsese is going to have an asthma attack. He's laughing so hard. Sex with a peacock. Watch King of Comedy again. Even better, watch the Blu-ray DVD, which I have for that Q&A. Jerry Lewis is fantastic. Well, the one joke he says, he goes, listen, Marty's brilliant. He goes, but he was always, it was ridiculous. He goes, the first two nights is where I first come out of my dressing room and Rupert Pupkin is there, De Niro's character. And Marty didn't use me at all. He goes, so we're shooting, and it's a night shoot. It's noon to 8. Or midnight to 8, excuse me, back nights. But the third night, Marty picks up the story because it's like 2 a.m. And somebody goes, hey, Jerry wants to speak to you. He's in his trailer. I'm like, oh, okay, go there. And Jerry Lewis says, Scorsese goes, listen, I'm the consummate professional. You're paying me for my time, whatever you need. But if at some point in the middle of the night you feel like you're probably not going to use me, just let me know. Like, then I'll just get going. Like, but if you're going to use me, that's fine. I have no issue with it. And Scorsese said he felt so bad. He's like, oh, I'm so selfish. I'm just torturing Jerry Lewis. So he said he saw him years later at the Venice Film Festival. He goes, hey, Jerry, look, I'm on time. And right away they started laughing. So they said there was a lot of takes making that movie. Because there was one scene where De Niro's asking the woman, he goes, are you speaking for you or are you speaking for Jerry? And Marty's not a guy who'll do a ton of takes, but he goes, we did like 25 takes because he goes, we just kept tinkering with it. He goes, Bob and I kept trying to figure out a little hostile, a little less hostile, a little more needy, a little more angry. He goes, there's a lot of violence in there. But Jerry Lewis is great. And at one point, De Niro says, he goes, you know, I hadn't seen the movie in so long because I thought Jerry was terrific. He goes, he really was really good. And he goes, well, obviously the way Marty makes everything kind of come together. And he goes, you know, I don't normally watch my movies. I have to have some distance from it. But, you know, it's been like 30 years, so it's okay. And then Jerry Lewis immediately goes, yeah, later tonight he's going to watch The Deer Hunter. He's just going to see how that movie holds up. Again, Scorsese laughing fit. So good. That is the King of Comedy. But on a somber note, rest in peace, the great Frank Vincent. Go get your shine box. He came to prominence in Raging Bull. Although he first got his acting role back in 1976 because his buddy was Joe Pesci. So Pesci put in a word for him, and he got a role in a gambling movie. And from there, Pesci basically told Marty, he's like, this guy's pretty good. You know, you want a bunch of Italian-Americans in your movie, he's going to make a lot of sense. And so Frank Vincent, he plays Salvi in Raging Bull. If you remember the one scene, he's out with Vicky, which is De Niro's, Jake LaMotta's wife in the movie. And eventually Pesci is furious with him because he thinks that, you know, whatever, he shouldn't be there with him. So eventually he's just slamming the car door on Salvi. And the next scene, Frank Vincent's got like this terrible cast and his face is all messed up. And Pesci has to apologize to him. And Vincent can like slaps him on the arm that's injured. He's like, come on, come on, come on, wash the arm. So if, it wasn't enough that Pesci got to give him a huge butt whipping there. Of course, in Goodfellas, one of the best scenes of the movie. It's so well done. The object of much destruction is Billy Batts. We first see him in the movie, of course, he's in the trunk. It's all bloody, and they start stabbing him and shooting him. But he's the one who just starts getting Tommy's goat, and he's telling us, and he knows exactly what he's doing. He's so clever about it. He knows that Pesci's this little trigger finger. So, you know, he first kind of says hello to him, but he feels like Pesci's a little bit standoffish. So then he seeks to humiliate him, which he does by mentioning that he was this little guy who used to make your shoes look like mirrors. And you can see Pesci, and it's great directing by Scorsese because you see him just slowly inching with the camera. He's dollying into Pesci, and he's slowly dollying into Vincent as they're both kind of just trading barbs. And Pesci's going back, hey, no more shines, Billy. He's like, what's the matter with you? Like, I'm just, you know, busting your chops, whatever. Slowly pushing it. And eventually, he tells him to go get a shine box. Boom! Camera stops because now Pesci goes berserk. He's like, yeah, come on, you feel strong. And De Niro's going to take him out. Later on, of course, they murder him. But it's such a great scene for Frank Vincent. Now, he got his revenge in Casino. So he finally gets to come back there. So he actually said to Marty, he goes, hey, thank God I got my butt whipped in Raging Bull and Goodfellas, and I finally got got Pesci back in Casino. He's got the baseball bat. Just completely annihilates Pesci and his brother in a violent scene. Along with those Scorsese roles, by the way, the film debut was Death Collector, a.k.a. Family Enforcer. That was back in 1976. He was friends with Pesci because they were nightclub collaborators. They're actually in a band together called The Artist O'Cats. Imagine that. Now it's time, ladies and gentlemen, for The Artist O'Cats, starring Frank Vincent and Joe Pesci. And then they got this movie together. So Death Collector apparently is just this blunt, no-budget mafia movie. Never seen it before. But, of course, that went to Raging Bull, Goodfellas. He's also in Do the Right Thing. He's got a really funny role in that. Jungle Fever. He plays Annabelle Siora's dad. So not only Marty, but Spike Lee is a director that took a fondness for Frank Vincent. And always interesting when you see these headlines when someone passes away. What are they known for? The main headline actually said Sopranos actor Frank Vincent. He played Phil Leotardo in the HBO, I would say HBO's greatest series, The Sopranos. He originally was the first option for Uncle Junior, but David Chase said, he didn't want to have too many Goodfellas actors in The Sopranos. Like he had enough of them already, so he didn't want them in prominent roles, and it would feel like Goodfellas 2.0. So he did not give Frank Vincent the role of Uncle Junior. He instead becomes Phil Leotardo, who is terrific in that. So, unfortunately, you would have thought, especially with De Niro and Pesci, who would have been great in The Irishman, I'm sure Marty would have found a role for Frank Vincent. But unfortunately, he is going to be missed. And like I said, I'm sure there's a giant shine box waiting for him up in heaven. Rest in peace, Frank Vincent, who passes away at the age of 78. Thanks so much for listening to Cinephile. Cannot wait to watch Darren Aronofsky's new movie, Mother, getting rave reviews, especially from Michelle Pfeiffer. Some critics are saying it's a little over the top, it's a little too demented, but it has shades of Black Swan, but everybody is unanimous. Pfeiffer's awesome on Gold Derby. She's the front runner right now for the Oscar for Best Supporting Actress. So next time, a review of Darren Aronofsky's new movie, Mother. Until then, I'll see you at the movies.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.